While Abakumov tortured Jews to create a new American conspiracy and destroy Mikhail's, Stalin, accompanied by Valichka, drove down to Abkhazia, where he believed the air and the food ensured longevity. Stalin based himself at Coldstream, but constantly moved to new houses. It is claimed that they were gloomy. Certainly the wood panelling was sombre, but when one visits them in summer, they are delightful. Stalin usually ate and worked outside on the verandas, and all had lush gardens full of flowers where he loved to walk. Above all, the houses were chosen for their vistas. The views from these grave houses are all breathtakingly beautiful. When he arrived on holiday, there was one ritual that was an echo of older times. Stalin hung Lenin's death mask on the wall, where it was illuminated like an icon with a burning lamp. The icon would always travel with him. He ordered his commandant, Arlov, to hang the face in the most visible place. As he moved in, the magnates arrived simultaneously at their local houses, waiting to be summoned. They dreaded having to spend any time with Stalin on holiday, which was worse than the dinners, according to Khrushchev, who once endured a whole month. Fighting the Ukrainian famine and separatism, Khrushchev remained under a temporary cloud as he recuperated. Stalin ordered Kaganovich to supervise Khrushchev and beat any nationalism out of the Ukrainians. Khrushchev and Kaganovich, longtime allies, lived cheek by jowl, their families going on walks every weekend. Inevitably, they soon became mortal enemies. Both appealed to Stalin, who summoned them to Coldstream. Over dinner and a movie, he stoked their hatred, enforced peace, and ultimately returned Kaganovich to Moscow. Stalin ate his meals outside, on the verandas, reading the papers. There were open magazines and books on virtually every surface and piles of papers. He still worked long into the evenings, starting his dinners late. Vlasik and Paskryobyshev did not always dine with the boss, but the chef de cabinet invited guests with the drear words, "Stalin awaits you." Sunburnt, grey-haired with a bald patch, thin-faced with a pot belly and sloping shoulders, Stalin met guests on the veranda like an affable Georgian countryman. Sometimes the housekeeper pointed the guests down the garden where they found Stalin wielding a spade, weeding his lemon trees, assisted by General Vlasik. "I'm showing you how to work." He showed off his lemons and roses, but his favourite flower, the mimosa, was an organic metaphor for his own secretive sensitivity, for when touched, it closed like a mouth. At the Georgian feast, often laid up outside, Stalin genially opened the bottles. The endless meals were agonizing for the magnates, who usually stayed the night. Stalin could be unsettlingly kind. When Mikoyan's brother, Artyom, designer of MiG aircraft, suffered angina and was put to bed, he was aware of someone coming into his room and tenderly laying a blanket over him. He was amazed to see it was Stalin. One thing united virtually all his house guests: the desire to escape this strange, nervy old man with his alternation of vicious, dangerous explosions, self-pitying regrets, and excruciatingly boring reminiscences. Their frantic and creative efforts to find excuses to leave their all-powerful but super-sensitive host without causing offense provide a comical theme to these long nights. Zhdanov came to help work out Stalin's policy for securing his hold over Eastern Europe. Molotov's tendency to negotiate with the West had ended with the rejection of the Marshall Plan. Now Zhdanov seemed to gain ascendancy in foreign as well as domestic policy, or rather he was naturally closer to his master's voice. Their relationship remained almost paternal. Stalin marked Zhdanov's speeches with schoolmasterly notes. "Must put in Lenin quotations," he scrawled in brown crayon on one. Together they created Zhdanov's speech that divided Europe into two camps, the ideological basis for the Iron Curtain over the next 40 years. To counteract the Marshall Plan and the discomforting independence of Tito's Yugoslavia, Stalin ordered Zhdanov to create a new Communist International, the Cominform, to enforce Soviet hegemony over Eastern Europe. Zhdanov, accompanied by his hated rival Malenkov, recently recalled to a lower post, then flew off to a secret police convalescent home in the Polish town of Skalaska Poreba. Here, the ruling communist parties from Poland to Yugoslavia awaited Moscow's instructions. Apart from giving his two-camp speech, Zhdanov behaved with all the blustering arrogance of an imperial viceroy. When Berman, one of the Polish leaders, the one who had waltzed with Molotov, expressed doubts about his Cominform, Zhdanov arrogantly replied, "Don't start throwing your weight around. In Moscow we know better how to apply Marxism-Leninism." At every stage, Stalin instructed Zhdanov and Malenkov on how to proceed. This was the high point of Zhdanov's career, and his greatest lasting achievement, if it can be called that. It was appropriate that the meeting was held in a sanatorium, because by the end of it, he was collapsing from alcoholism and heart failure. He may have triumphed over Molotov, Malenkov, and Beria, but he could not control his own strength. Zhdanov, only 51 but exhausted, knew he wasn't strong enough to bear the responsibility of succeeding Stalin. "He never wanted power," asserts his son. He flew back to the seaside to recover near Stalin, but then suffered a heart attack. Zhdanov's illness created a vacuum that was keenly filled by Malenkov and Beria, who became so close they even sent their greetings to Stalin jointly that November, writing, "We derive great happiness from working under your rule. Devoted to you, L. Beria and G. Malenkov." Yet their friendship was always political. Beria really thought Malenkov spineless, nothing but a billy goat. Zhdanov noticed their resurgence, but he was too weak to fight this vicious battle.